Welcome to New Books in World Music, devoted to discussions with scholars of world music and ethnomusicology. I'm your host, Garrett Field, and today I'm talking with Amanda Weidman from Bryn Mawr College about her new book, Singing the Classical, Voicing the Modern, The Postcolonial Politics of Music in South India. Singing the Classical, Voicing the Modern is primarily about how the term classical music emerged in the colonial encounter to describe South Indian Carnatic music, and also about how the voice in South India came to be imagined as a difference between India and the West. This book is a history of ideas about central facets of South Indian music in the 20th century, how the violin in Carnatic music came to be conceptualized as both modernizer and preserver of authenticity, how ideologies of the South Indian voice were linked to notions of family values and ideal womanhood, how Carnatic music began to be described as a kind of language, and how the notion of a composer having sole authorship emerged in the 20th century. A landmark in the study of South Indian Carnatic music, Singing the Classical, Voicing the Modern makes an immense contribution to both ethnomusicology and anthropology of South Asia. Thank you for joining us, Amanda.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for that lovely introduction.
So could you start off by telling us about your background? What brought you to ethnomusicology and to the study of South Indian music?
Well, I actually started out as a kind of late-blooming Western classical violinist. Although I had some failed piano lessons when I was six or seven, I didn't start learning Western classical violin until I was 9 or 10. And I didn't actually realize how interested I was in it until I was sort of later on in high school. And by then it was kind of late to consider going to conservatory and all that. So I ended up going to college, and I studied anthropology. But the whole time I was actually very interested in practicing my violin. I think I was really looking for some way to combine what was exciting to me sort of intellectually about anthropology and about the possibility of things being different elsewhere. With my interest in music and in playing music. And so it all happened rather accidentally. I didn't know anything about India or South India, but in my, I think when I was a junior in college, I happened to hear a Carnatic music concert, and I saw that there was someone on stage playing the violin. And I was like, hey, that's my instrument, you know, what are they doing, and why are they playing it that way? And I was quite taken with it, with the idea of it, I should say, because I don't think at that point I could really appreciate the music much. But I was an undergraduate at Bryn Mawr College, where I now teach, at the time. And I ended up studying with the person who was the violinist that night. His name is Adrian Larmond, and he still lives in Swarthmore, Pennsylvania. And in fact, we still play together sometimes. And so I studied with him, and he introduced me to not only the technique of playing violin in Carnatic music, but also to the melodic and especially the rhythmic intricacies of the music. And I kind of started to see that this was something that you could really get into for a lifetime. And so I studied with him for a couple of years, and then I decided to go to graduate school in anthropology, But I was actually, I wanted to make, I pretty soon I realized I wanted to make South Indian music the topic of my graduate study. So I was approaching it from an anthropological perspective. And I made my first visit to, I guess it was still Madras then, in 1993. And I have to say, one of the things that actually got me very interested in the music, but also in the sort of social history of the music was listening to the stories that my first teacher, Adrian Larmand, told me about Madras in the 1960s, which is when he was there working as a violinist for the film studios and also learning Carnatic violin himself. And so I heard all these stories of musicians doing crazy things and all this kind of politics. And so I was quite taken with that, and I wanted to go check out what this place was for myself. So I made my first trip to Madras in 1993, and I made like probably five more trips in the course of the 1990s. First couple were to study music there and to get a sense of what I could do. And then I realized that I wanted to write something about the social history of Carnatic music. And so I spent a year in Madurai studying Tamil, and I picked up a couple of other music teachers while I was there. I've had entirely too many teachers, although it's been good, actually. And then I did the bulk of the research for this book was done in 1997 and 98, with some more follow-up in the early 2000s.
So it's, you know, it's easy to take for granted the kind of hard work that goes into research and writing of a book like this, but you draw on an array of ethnographic experiences and readings of a large and diverse body of local Tamil and English sources. So can you tell us a little bit about your research?
Yeah. Well, I was kind of interested, I guess, you know, in as much as I had a plan, I was, of course, interested in learning music myself and in trying to use the kind of embodied musical knowledge that I was gaining to shape my research questions. At least now looking back, I can rationalize it that way. For instance, as a violinist, I was obviously, you know, interested in the role of the violin in South Indian music. And, it was quite striking to me that, you know, this is such a prominent instrument in the musical tradition, and it's absolutely necessary in every concert. And yet the music is talked about as, you know, being vocal music, and it is vocal music also. But I was interested in, you know, exactly what kind of role this instrument, this colonial instrument, was playing. So it was really a question, like a research question, that sprung out of my my own experience as a student of the music. And so then I started looking for various ways that I could look at, that I could trace the history of the violin in South India. And so there are, of course, there are written sources, and a lot of those I happened on in libraries in Tanjore, in the state archives in Madras, and various other libraries. But there's also the compositions themselves, especially that I talk about in the chapter on the violin. Just looking at certain kinds of compositions can give you a clue to their history. And so I was really interested in the role of the violin as kind of bringing Western influences into Carnatic music. And then, of course, it was so interesting to me that this colonial instrument could then be seen as a, you know, as a perfectly Indian accompaniment to the voice.
Yes.
So, in terms of sources, I spent, you know, a good amount of time just kind of trying to find as much as I could, anywhere I could, on, you know, people just talking about music, especially from the decades of the, I would say the 20s through the 50s. Sort of critical for constructing Carnatic music as a high cultural classical art music. So it was actually really more retrospectively, as I was figuring out what I was going to write in the book, that I began to see some patterns in any of the things that I had gathered. But, you know, I think when you write your first book, you're always a little bit less systematic, I guess. But, yeah, I was interested also in the difference between what I could find written in Tamil versus what I would find written in English. And so I think where most of the Tamil language sources come out are probably in the chapter on music and language and the politics of the Tamil music movement. But I thought it was important to use Tamil sources because there's a lot written on Carnatic music in English, and it would have been possible actually to limit oneself to English language sources, but I didn't want to do that.
Yeah, the depth of all the Tamil sources you used really is apparent in the chapters. So in the introduction, you make one of your main points that your main arguments that South Indian Carnatic music was constituted in your words and by the colonial encounter.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you feel it was important to make this argument?
A lot of what I was kind of doing in this book was working against, I guess, what I see as the sort of major, the ways in which the tradition of Carnatic music is narrated as this this sort of pure and ancient tradition that has resisted foreign influences, and I found that that narrative actually excluded not only the possibility that Carnatic music was influenced by, you know, Western things such as the violin, but also it also excluded the history of, you know, what sorts of things had to be pushed aside or excluded to make this definition of what could be considered Carnatic, proper Carnatic classical music. So, for instance, the whole history of the contributions of Devadasi community to Carnatic music, which Davesh Soneji's book has just wonderfully brought this out. It's a terrific book.
I have to read that. I know it just came out in, I think, Chicago, or it's this, yeah. It's the new...
you should definitely do an interview on that one.
Yeah.
But I found that the way that Carnatic music has been narrated has excluded lots of things. All right, so part my overall project was to show how to challenge, you know, some of the truths that are you know, assumed by that narrative. So that's where the idea of Carnatic music as being produced through the colonial encounter comes in. That it was, I guess what I'm trying to say is that without the colonial encounter happening, you know, we might not have the same sort of setup as we have today in terms of, you know, classical music traditions. And I think an important point is that I was trying to make is that when saying something like Carnatic music was produced through the colonial encounter, first of all, it's not just that it was an imposition from the West.
Right, yeah.
It was a process of engagement with certain kinds of concepts and sounds that came from the West, but that were worked on in various ways in South India. But the other point that I hope the book makes is that it's not only talking about discourse about music. So there's one of the things I was working against in this book was this idea that, you know, oh, well, there are musicologists and scholars, you know, in India who will say all sorts of things about music, and so there's a musicological discourse, and then there's what the musicians actually do, right?
Yeah.
That, especially in the North Indian context, I think that divide has some salience. There is definitely, you know, a discourse about music, and then there is musical practice, and they don't always match up. And that's true in South India as well. But when I'm making the point that Carnatic music was produced through the colonial encounter, I'm not just saying that the discourse about it was produced, right, and that,
yeah,
and that the music kind of remains the same. I'm trying to, at least I was trying to make the point that the whole thing was affected by this encounter, right? And it's not just a matter of you know, how people wrote about or talked about music, but it's also a matter of how people sang and played music that changed.
Yeah, well, I mean, although you write a lot about discourse, I think it is clear that, you write about how the violin, just the violin itself is, you know, is making music. And then but you also, I think, and we can talk about this later, write about the way that, recording technologies influence the music. So I think you were successful in making that argument. And then in the introduction, you also write about how the voice, this is, the book is kind of like two books in one, because another really important theme is about the voice. So how the voice in the 20th century, it comes to stand in for this difference between the India and the West. And, before we really begin to talk about the first chapter about the violin, can you tell us, what discourses were you drawing on to talk about the voice as a historical object?
No, good question. I when I was working on this book, probably as the kinds of sources that I cite, you know, in the introduction, I guess there's kind of a sort of semi-literature review on voice as a concept, and this again is symptomatic of first books where you feel like you have to get everything into the book. But it was actually in the course of figuring out this project and figuring out this book that I became interested in the issue of voice more generally. And there really weren't a lot of things at the time that I could draw on that didn't kind of take voice as this sort of universally significant pre-cultural thing. All the psychoanalytic and deconstructive writing about the voice can be very valuable, but it doesn't really give you any purchase on thinking about sound and about the particular ways that the reasons that, you know, people sing and perform certain ways, right? Or how that came to be. So, So I really didn't have any models of stuff that talked, you know, that treated the voice as a historical or a historicizable thing when I was writing this book. And I guess I was trying to feel my way towards that. So I think possibly the project that I'm doing now, which I guess we'll talk about later, might actually fulfill that a little bit more than this book does. But I think the book really, although I'm trying to feel my way towards, you know, the voice as a historical object, I think the book actually touches more on, in some ways, on the figure of the voice as something that comes to stand for authenticity and Indianness. So, you know, unfortunately, I'm not a vocalist. So perhaps if I was, I would have had more to say about singing practices themselves. That's something that I wish, you know, could have been in the book more. Because I think that would have helped some of the arguments that I'm trying to make about the sort of emergence of the voice as a figure for talking about authenticity and Indianness.
Wow, so it sounds like you're really trying to even go farther and to look to like sound itself or to vocal practice. Let's talk about the voice in a little bit. But let's go into the first chapter. So you focus on the violin in Carnatic music, and you one of the very compelling things you say is that you talk about how violin became both a sign of the modern and a preserver of authenticity. So can you tell us more about how the violin came to play this dual role?
It's quite sort of a contradiction seemingly there, right? Between something that can be sort of a sign of the modernity of the music, but also something that can preserve, you know, what is authentic about it.
Yeah.
And I actually still find that it's contradictory, and it's a fascinating sort of formulation. Yeah. It's a fascinating formulation, because it's like this, you know, if we use this instrument to, like, sort of represent the music and to play the music, then a lot of the, you know, what I found the people writing and talking about the violin, they said, oh, it makes the music sound better. And you can sort of understand the music better from the violin. So it was like the idea that it makes the voice even clearer. I found that to be a very interesting way of talking about the music. And I think one of the things that that chapter kind of led me to think about was the way that musical instruments signify, and that they that, you know, you could probably do this with any instrument, but just to look at the history of how people talk about it, right? The discourse about this instrument and what it's thought to be doing in the music.
Yeah.
And the violin, I mean, you're totally right to point out like this very contradictory way in which it is imagined. And I think also part of that contradiction comes out again in the practice of accompaniment in South Indian music, which you know a lot about. The idea that you're following the solo line, right, and heeding it, and you're sort of emphasizing certain things about it, but you are not the soloist. Right. But you have like this incredible power in the performance context, right? You have a lot of power to shape how the soloist is heard, and so that's another aspect of the way that the violin has been imagined, that it has this power to shape how Carnatic music is heard, but it's not necessarily seen as a Western imposition.
Yeah.
I find it fascinating. I still find it fascinating.
Yeah, and that's that was also a very interesting link that you made between anthropology of voice and violin performance. How the violin is kind of like you say, it's kind of making the voice even more alive. And you write a lot about how Tyagaraja, the famous composer, responded to hearing the voice, the violin. And so the first chapter is all about the violin, how it's exploring how it signifies and the role that it came to play in Carnatic music. And then we move into the second chapter, which is about the way in which a new type of concert culture it came into being for Carnatic music. So what were these new features and their impacts on Carnatic concert culture?
Part of the newness of things had to do with the move of musicians to Madras City. And so part of this chapter is just narrating that shift. Paint things kind of broadly, in the 19th century, the centers of musical culture in South India were the princely states of Mysore, Tanjore, and smaller ones like Ramanathapuram. And in the late 19th century, these basically were pretty much beginning to be dismantled, and a lot of musicians moved from these smaller cities to the city of Madras, which presented certain opportunities. So there was a new kind of concert culture developing in Madras. There was the development of sabhas, which were associations that would put on concerts. They would organize concerts and hire musicians to come and perform, and they would charge money for tickets for the audience, and that's how they would support themselves. So there was a new structure that came into being. And along with that, there were also new kinds of institutions for learning music that were springing up. So the founding of music departments and colleges of music were also part of this. But I think the part of it that was most interesting to me was the actual staging of the music and the new concert format that came about. Thinking about what were the effects of that format. So there is a particular format, which you know very well, for Carnatic music concerts, where there'll be an introductory piece, and then there's, probably 8 or 9 compositions in the course of 2 hours, and one of them is taken as the main composition, and then is elaborated on in improvisation more than the others. And then sort of assumed in this format is that there are certain ragas that are like heavy or serious ragas, and there are other ones that are light or not so serious. And so the second part of the concert after the main item usually is, you know, devoted to songs that are lighter or less serious in nature.
Right.
And, you know, and then culminating in the, what do they call it? Tukara, right?
Yeah, because yeah. It's
miscellaneous, right? So the miscellaneous little short pieces that are included at the end kind of as fun things before the concert's over. Now, I actually found, I've always found the tukara section of the concert to be really interesting. And one of the things I wished I had done while I was really doing my research on this was I wished that I had actually more systematically taken notes on or even recorded what was being performed as tukara. Because I think it's an interesting place in the concert where, you know, you can have javalis, which are compositions, associated with the Devadasi or courtesan repertoire. You can have Hindustani-like pieces, you know, sort of foreign things. You can have the English note, which were, you know, pieces that were basically inspired by Scottish and Irish jigs that people heard during the colonial period. You could have film songs as part of the tukara. So it's like a place where everything that's excluded as non-classical, right, it sort of penned in the tukara part.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, there's this sort of gradation of what is considered to be really serious, you know, improvisation-worthy heavy ragas and what is considered to be lighter. And I, you know, like, I always had trouble just on my own. Like, I could never tell, just as in my own experience as a student of music, you know, I would like learn some raga and I would say, oh, this is a great raga. This must be like considered really serious and heavy because I find lots of ways to improvise in this one. And, you know, and then my teacher would be like, oh no, this is just a light. No one improvises in this. So I got kind of interested in how these sort of value distinctions came about. You know, one thing that's actually quite interesting is that there's a group of compositions, which, again, I'm sure you know about, called the Pancharatna Kritis, right? So the five gems of Tyagaraja, this composer. And these are all composed in ragas that now you don't really hear people elaborating and improvising in these ragas that much anymore. And
yeah, right. That's really interesting. I forget that, but you do write about how it became more how the music became more composition oriented.
Yeah, well, these compositions, like the way I've heard them performed, like they're always just performed as the composition itself. Like there's not even any alapana, like, you know, improvised elaboration of the raga before launching into the piece. They just perform them as compositions.
Yeah.
And there's no improvisation afterwards either. And I actually asked people about this, and my teacher said that her father, who was, you know, like a violinist active in the 30s, 40s, 50s, that he would improvise on these pieces and he would take them as the main item in his concert.
Wow.
So there's obviously there have been shifts in what people consider to be like, just at the level of, like, the music itself here, right? Like,
yeah.
There have been these shifts in what people consider to be heavy, serious, you know, the real stuff of Carnatic music. And so I didn't really sort of systematically do that in the book, but it's one of the things that I was gesturing towards, I guess.
And that leads us to the next chapter, because in addition to, you know, ragas and types of improvisation being heavy or serious, there is also this gendered component to it. And you write about how, you know, certain improvisations came to be considered where it wasn't proper for women to perform these masculine forms of improvisation. And this is the third chapter where you really, but you mostly focus on the nexus of voice and gender. And you dedicate some of the chapter to the life of M.S. Subbalakshmi and also the things that the music community said about her voice. So what about M.S. Subbalakshmi inspired you to focus attention on gender and voice in South Indian music?
Yeah.
Okay. Did you hear my question?
Yeah, I heard your question. Okay. So I'm answering about M.S. Subbalakshmi.
Yeah.
It's partly that she's so celebrated, and that at least for a while, I have to say, until I wrote this chapter and published stuff like about this, it seemed to me that there was this incredible consensus about her as a wonderful musician and a great voice, and so I was interested in, you know, just in that fact and what role she played in the imagination of Carnatic music in the 20th century. So I was kind of less interested in the sort of actual facts of her life than in what she signified, I guess. Although the facts of her life are important too. I've actually been learning quite a bit more about her in my current project on film singers, because she sang for films in the 1940s, late 30s, and early 40s.
Was that controversial that she was singing? I had no idea that she sang film music.
She did. That's actually how she became known, through her gramophone recordings of film songs first, and then she married S. Sadasivam, who was a Brahmin, and she of course came from a Devadasi background, you know, everyone talks about how he Brahminized her, and so
it's a loaded term.
He kind of managed her career, obviously, but he oversaw her acting in these films. So she was a singing actress. This was the period before playback singing. So the actors and actresses themselves sang. And she played, she acted only in four films, and then she left the world of films to focus on her classical music. And, but the films actually, they kind of represented her almost as herself. It's kind of interesting that they were also a vehicle for sort of staging her devoted musicianship. Especially, there's a film from 1945, I think the last film she acted in, called Mira, which is about the life of this Saint Mira, who sort of gives up all her worldly affairs and possessions to become a devotee of Krishna. And M.S. Subbulakshmi plays Mira in this movie, and the movie is just full of, you know, M.S. Subbulakshmi singing, and these sort of close-up shots of her enraptured singing. And that was also very much the image that she projected on stage when she sang Carnatic concerts, too, that, you know, she presented herself as a devotee, singing. And so I was interested in, you know, what she represented in a larger sense, and how her life, and, you know, particularly the her transition from her origins in the Devadasi community to basically being, you know, the adored singer of the Brahmin establishment in Madras, how that happened and how that kind of mirrors a larger shift. So that is why I spent a lot of that chapter on her as a figure. I actually, the last time I was in Chennai, I came across an Amar Chitra Katha. It's a comic book series in India that, you know, they do all kinds of mythological and historical comic books for kids. There's actually one on M.S. Subbulakshmi now.
Wow. So she's portrayed as like a saint or something?
She's, well, it portrays her girlhood, and, you know, she grew up with her mother, who was a musician, who was a Devadas.
The connection was lost. Hello? Yeah. Okay, you're back. The audio just kind of faded out. Hello?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. So she was how was she portrayed in that cartoon?
She's portrayed as she's growing up as a girl in Madurai, and her mother is bringing her up, and her mother is a musician from the Devadasi community, and then her mother brings her to Madras, and she's kind of discovered by various people, including the man who would become her husband. And she basically portrays her as running away from her mother and into the arms of her husband, but like all the while guided by this, you know, incredible love of music. It's kind of an interesting document.
Yeah, I bet.
Figure out how to... Well, a lot of stuff has come out on M.S. Subbulakshmi since I wrote this book, actually. There have been a couple of, like, 3 or 4 biographies, and, you know, other stuff like what I just described. She passed away in the time... that I can't remember exactly when she passed away, but that was the occasion for a lot of stuff being written about her, too.
Yeah, it reminds me of the... You spend some time in the second chapter writing about the way that all these biographies of musicians from the courts started to appear in, I think, the early 20th century, and there's just all this nostalgia for, you know, before the... Madras had become like more like a business. There's all this nostalgia about the old golden days. So it's interesting to think what these texts about M.S. Subbulakshmi mean. And So, okay, so after we have this chapter on MS Subbalakshmi and also really about gender and the voice, we turn to the Tamil music movement, and you analyze all these discourses that made the Tamil music movement possible, and you write about Swaminathayyar's writings, and you write how the music and language came to be imagined as in separate realms. I think in the early 20th century. Mm-hmm. And this chapter, it's just rich with explorations of ideas by South Indian musicologists and reformers, people like who I hadn't read anything about, H.P. Krishna Rao, Abraham Panditar, T.K. Chidambaranath, the Mudaliar, and Kalki Krishnamurti. And they all had these ideas about the relationship between music and language. So what was at stake in their ideas? Some thought that music was like a universal language, where others believed that it was important to put the Tamil language on par with Telugu and Sanskrit compositions.
Yeah, well, this is, a lot of the debates that I kind of look at in this chapter about the need for Tamil music. They arose in the 1930s and 40s, and this was in the context of the rise of Dravidian politics in Tamil Nadu, and so the political parties that now dominate and have since the since the late 1960s are coming, kind of being formulated in this period. One of the aspects of forming this Tamil Dravidian identity was that it was supposedly separate from and uninfluenced by, or ideally uninfluenced by, Sanskrit and by North India. And so how this played out in the world of music was that the predominance of Telugu compositions, in the Telugu language, that were the bulk of what was sung, on Carnatic music stages. This was suddenly seen as something that was not good, by particular people, and so the demand was, we need to have music in our mother tongue. And, so we need to have Tamil music in Tamil Nadu and let them sing Telugu songs in Andhra Pradesh. And so it was like this sort of imagination of, music along linguistic lines. And it very much reflected the politics of the time. And it was also, the debate about music in Tamil was not confined to classical music in South India. It was also being conducted in the world of film music. So there were people, talking about how there shouldn't be any songs in Telugu when it's a Tamil film and stuff like that. So I guess what I was trying to look at was, the kinds of reasons and justifications that were given for these arguments, and also what kind of assumptions they rested on. And so the idea that, when you can only really appreciate music that's in your mother tongue, is... something that could be challenged, right?
And yeah.
So, and there were people arguing on both sides.
Both sides, yeah.
For various reasons. And What's interesting, I mean, the Tamil music movement, as it turned out, it didn't have, you know, that much of an effect on what was considered to be the canon of Carnatic music. I mean, even now, I mean, all the heavy, serious sort of main pieces are Telugu. You know, they're all still by the so-called trinity of composers who composed either in Telugu or Sanskrit.
Right.
So it didn't have much of an effect in changing what was considered to be canon, but it did generate a lot of discourse and a lot of sentiment. And so that's, I think, why I was interested in it. You know, that it generated all sorts of ideas about Tamilness and certain things that sort of stayed with us. Like, so the very poignant moment in Uwe Swaminath Iyer's memoir of his childhood. So he was a little boy in the late 1900s, and he was studying Tamil literature, various ancient Tamil literature, and he also wanted to study music, right? And he writes in his memoir that he wanted to do both, but his he had to choose one,
right?
Because these were becoming constructed as two separate fields, right? You were either a Carnatic classical musician or you were a Tamil literary scholar, and the two worlds didn't overlap. And that is sort of true today too. Very much true today.
So, and then in the next chapter, you write about music reformers use notation and conceptualize notation. It kind of had this dual role, kind of like the violin. It was like you say that it was a possible site of resistance to the encroachment of Western classical music, but others imagine it as a space of progress. And I would just like to touch on one point that I thought was extraordinarily interesting, which is your discussion of mudras. So mudras are the people often call them composer signatures, and in you write about the way that how the mudra kind of epitomizes a different set of values about authorship. So can you talk a little bit about that and really anything about what you felt to be fascinating about all these different ideas about notation that were coming into being in the 20th century in South India?
The issue of the mudra is quite interesting because it brings out this contrast between a sort of modern notion of authorship, where you sign your name to something, and that means that you are the creator of it, and you know, it's your intellectual property, and people have to cite you. But the mudra was actually something different, as far as I can tell. It was, in many cases, it was a name that a composer would use. Well, in some cases, it was a name that the composer would use to refer to themselves, but they were always referring to themselves as the devotee of somebody, right? So,
yeah.
So Tyagaraja signs his name. He says Tyagaraja in the charnam of all his kirtanas, but it's to say that he's, you know, forever the devotee of Rama or whoever, right? And then in some other cases, the mudra is actually the name of a temple deity that somebody is composing the piece or singing the piece in honor of. Right, so it's not actually the composer or the singer's name at all.
Hmm.
And so there, that you know, then you get the possibility of people using a particular mudra to, you know, possibly to make sure that their piece is heard or passed on. But they're not necessarily doing that by claiming their own authorship of the piece. So all of these, I guess, the mudra would be interesting to further explore as a, you know, as in terms of strategies for getting your piece passed on, because you have to remember this is all particularly happening in an oral transmission context. And that sort of comes into conflict with modern ideas of authorship and the composer, right? Which these become important once you start publishing stuff in printed form and you need to attribute the song to a composer.
Yes.
Yeah.
Let's see, we're almost running out of time, but I want to ask you about the last chapter. It's about how technologies of sound production, like gramophone and radio, it brought about these new practices of listening and performing. So can you tell us a little bit about that, how what this impact was on listening and performing South Indian music?
Yeah, you know, this is something I think needs a lot more exploration. I mean, just as a small example, I think that, you know, the possibility of listening to yourself or listening to somebody else over and over again, especially when it's an improvisation, you know, in the context of music that is improvised, it really changes the it changes your relationship to the process of improvisation. And this is not something that I particularly focused on in that chapter, but I guess it's something that the chapter, you know, writing it made me think about more, you know, which is, you know, what the possibilities for musicians are now when we have, like, this incredible wealth of recorded stuff that we can go to and listen to, like, 50 versions of somebody, you know, improvising in the Raga Kalyani, and we can compare the versions, and we can listen to them at half speed, and study them, and memorize them, and that must have a huge effect on the process of improvising. And it's not something that I actually wrote about in the book, but I think other people have written about this in the context of jazz improvisation. But it's something that, you know, deserves more exploration.
Yeah, and you also write about the way that also, just the printing of large manuals of music also changed people's ideas about repertoires. You know, whereas musicians may have had a repertoire of, I don't know, 20 or 30 pieces, then the idea that they could be, you know, they could have just this mass repertoire kind of was influenced at least by the printing of these large manuals. And well, we're almost running out of time, and it's been really terrific talking with you, Amanda. And my final question is, what's next? Do you have any projects that you're currently working on?
Yes, I am. I've actually been working on a project on playback singers in the Tamil film industry. I've been working on this project for a few years now, and I'm focusing on female singers. So playback singers are the singers who record their voices in the studio, and then they're called playback singers because they're recorded voices are then played back on the set, and the actors and actresses who are doing the dancing around in the song and dance scenes in the films, they lip sync to the pre-recorded playback singer's voice. Mm-hmm. If it's a lip sync song, or they act according to it, whatever. So it's a project about film music. But particularly about the changes that the female voice has gone through since the beginning of playback singing, which kind of began in the late 40s as a profession, to the present. And so there have been lots of changes in the ways that female singers are expected to sound, and also how they're expected to project themselves and be in public, how they dress, how they perform on stage. So I'm looking at these changes in the context of basically the post-independence era, the 50s and 60s, to the present, and kind of trying to give an oral voice and sound oriented history of, these larger societal changes in India that have to do with independence and nation building, and then post economic liberalization.
It sounds fascinating. I would like to thank our listeners for joining us today, and I want to thank Amanda Weidman for talking to us about her fascinating new book, Singing the Classical, Voicing the Modern, The Postcolonial Politics of Music in South India.
Well, thank you for the interview.
You have been listening to New Books in World Music. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.